From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. Fall is in the air. That means cooler temperatures, pumpkin spice lattes, and football are all back. And already we've seen both the UNLV Rebels and the Nevada Wolfpack take the field, each scoring their first win of the season. As for the Raiders, their newly revamped lineup will play host to the Miami Dolphins this Sunday, September 13th. So to help us better prepare for what to expect on the gridiron this season, I'm joined now by Case Kiefer, assistant sports editor for the Las Vegas Sun. Also with us is Mark Anderson, who covers Las Vegas sports for the Associated Press. Case, Mark, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us on, Paul.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Big moves in the offseason for the Raiders. That includes hiring a new head coach, Clint Kubiak, and drafting former Indiana quarterback Fernando Mendoza first in the NFL draft earlier this year. Case, what's Kubiak been up to during that time frame?
Just football, football, and more football. I know that sounds strange, but that's really the talk with him, is this guy is just all football. He's so singularly focused, so intense. And I feel like he's brought a lot to the organization in that regard. You see some of his the way he draws up offense. Some of his plays have already caught the eyes of, I think, the NFL world at large in the preseason. And certainly being media, we get to see it every day in practice. It does seem like he has a great offensive mind and just brings a professionalism and, like I said, an intensity that I think was sorely needed for this franchise.
Mark, there is a lot of hype around Mendoza. Is he really all that he's cracked up to be?
Honestly, we just don't know yet. I think so. We've seen flashes. I remember that first preseason game. He hit Malik Benson over the middle between three defenders. It's like, not many quarterbacks can pull that off. You see that and you think, well, that's why he was the number one pick. But you've also seen the inconsistencies you expect out of a rookie. He's been a little careless with the ball at times. He's still trying to learn how to read NFL defenses. It's going to take a while. I think he's going to be good, but you know, the fact is we just don't know yet.
Case, right now, Coach Kubiak has veteran quarterback Kirk Cousins starting on Sunday over Mendoza. Why is he doing that?
Well, the line that both Kirk Cousins and Clint Kubiak have repeated over and over is that when Kirk Cousins came here, he was promised that the best quarterback would play the best quarterback in training camp through the preseason. And it's just living up to that word. I mean, anyone that's watched all the snaps both these guys have taken, I mean, Kirk Cousins has just looked very far ahead of Fernando Mendoza, which I guess you could take as a problem. I mean, usually in this age of the NFL, you want your number one overall pick to be out there right now. However, I do agree with Mark. I'm not concerned long-term yet. We do see Fernando Mendoza kind of doing all the little things right. I do think all the intangibles are there. Everyone speaks so highly of the kid. I know he's putting in a ton of work, but he wasn't exactly great in training camp or even the preseason the last two games. So he just did not quite look ready yet. And the Raiders had this plan in place, a little bit of a break from other teams recently in a different situation that want to get that clock ticking on a rookie contract and have a team have a player take his lumps right away. They decided, let's make sure he's 100% ready. And frankly, I don't think he's looked 100% ready quite yet.
We've seen a strong commitment to revamping the offense, but what about the other side of the ball? The Raiders defense last season was ultimately ranked 14th in the NFL. Has the team done anything to improve that aspect of the game, Case?
I think the big headlining move was at linebacker. They just spent a ton of money, which is something the Raiders haven't done for years and years. And really kind of the rest of the NFL it's been the position that's kind of dropped off on the pay scale compared to some others. But the Raiders kind of zigged this year by giving both Quay Walker and N'Kobe Dean, former teammates from the great Georgia teams that won the national championship years ago in college. They reunite them. They both got about three-year, $40 million deals in that ballpark. So you would hope that really improves the Raiders on the second level, which was a huge problem spot last year. Probably their worst part of the defense last year. They just didn't have really any help behind Max Crosby. There still are a lot of concerns. I think we saw some of them in the preseason. I think the secondary is probably at best mediocre. Cornerbacks, the second cornerback spot is a real problem spot. They're ended up going with Darian Porter, a second year guy who's been solid but kind of unoutstanding. But the Raiders are in such a bad position coming off of last year. It's just that they couldn't address every single thing in the offseason with the way the salary cap works. So they kind of had to pick and choose their spots, and this is going to be kind of a slow build towards Mendoza. You hope you unearth some right pieces in there this year. They got some rookies behind the starters. So I think it's going to be a problem in the secondary, but they're going to try to work through it and hopefully find some young guys that can help going forward.
Well, the situation really can't get any worse than it was last season for the Raiders. So, Mark, any bold predictions for this season?
Not so much a prediction, but I think what fans should look out for is how are they playing, say, the final 6 weeks of the season. If you feel like it's on the proper trajectory, say Fernandez, and they're starting and making enough plays, you think, okay, he's the franchise quarterback. And they're at least competitive, and you finish, you know, reasonably well. I think that's what fans need to look for, especially after the brutal stretch to begin this season. So if I'm a Raiders fan, that's what I really want to see at the end of the season, that you got some hope going into 2027. Because I remember last year, there was a point in the season that there just wasn't any hope. And it was just a miserable final stretch. And the only thing they had to play for was really the top pick, which they got. At least with Fernando at the Boeing, they actually have hope. And if he can go in there and just show something down the stretch, I think that's big.
Before we switch gears, Case, I want to get your thoughts. You know, what are your bold predictions for this coming season?
Ooh, bold predictions. I kind of agree with Mark. I just think I know people are excited. They got a lot of new faces. It's just hard to see them being that competitive this year, or really like competing for a playoff spot or something. So you just want to see some progress. When, you know, they set the bar pretty low last year, but maybe get to that. If you get to the 7-win mark or even the 6-win mark, you feel pretty good. So just be a functional operation, which the Raiders have not been much in recent years. And I think you're on the right path.
All right, I want to take a moment and talk about college football. The season is already underway for both UNLV and Nevada. UNLV is 1-1 after losing their season opener to Memphis, but dominated against Hawaii last week. Nevada also performed well, routing Western Kentucky last Saturday, September 5th. Case, what are you going to be keeping your eye on as the season progresses for both teams?
Maybe we have two good college football teams in Nevada for the first time in a while, because it was certainly impressive what the Wolfpack did to Western Kentucky last week. And, man, a really fun game this week with Jeff Choate's former school, Montana State, the FCS powerhouse. I know that game kind of looks like a coin flip. And UNLV, I know, had super high expectations. Everyone is disappointed to already lose a game, but I still think they're at the top of the conference. They're just as likely to win it as anyone. I think there's four or five teams that are about even in the Mountain West. So they go to North Texas, of course, this week, another tough game. So two good games this week for both of our in-state schools. And I think it's setting up. Maybe this is it could be, at least for the early returns, the best these two teams have been at the same time in a while.
All right, let's talk about the WNBA and the Aces for a moment. There are four regular season games left, meaning the team is on track to reach the WNBA playoffs for the 8th consecutive year. Mark, how's the team looking heading into the postseason?
I was much more optimistic about their chances before Nelissa Smith got hurt. I think that's just a killer injury for them. Now, after last season, I learned you just don't count out the Aces. They looked dead in the water last year, also early August. So, I already thought they were players short. I thought they had that player when they had Kennedy Carter. Obviously, that didn't work out. She's had a hard time no matter what team she's been with. A great talent, and she was having a fantastic season, but if they'd had her and Melissa Smith hadn't gotten hurt, I think they would have been right there with a chance to, with Minnesota, maybe Indiana, to win it all. But I think once losing Carter was tough, but once Melissa went out, I just think that's just too much to overcome. And in this weird break for the World Cup comes at a strange, generally strange time. You just, you know, maybe it's what they need, but they get, I think, 5 or 6 players playing over there. So it's not like they're getting a break, much of a rest. So I think it looks like it's Minnesota's to lose at this point, but it's also Minnesota's lose last season. So you never know. I do like the way Indiana's playing. They were really coming on down the stretch. So those to me are the two best play teams, but then again, the Aces, you just never know what's going to happen in the postseason. So you get some players hurt, and suddenly the Aces are the ones standing tall at the end. But I just don't see it this time.
Aja Wilson has also continued to dominate the WNBA. At the end of last month, she was named the Western Conference Player of the Week for the 32nd time in her career. She's now one, award away from the all-time league record. That's in addition to being the league's reigning MVP. Just how important is she to this team?
Well, she's basically carrying the team right now. I mean, obviously, Jackie Young's great. Chelsea Gray's great. But, you know, they wouldn't be anywhere near contention without her. She's going to win the MVP again. I mean, it's almost locked in that she's going to win it again. She's making the case for greatest of all time. I think she's probably already there at this point. She's already won a record number of MVPs. She's just going to add to it. She's not showing any signs of slowing down. That's the most impressive thing to me about her is she keeps adding to her game every year. She finds some way to improve, and you won't find many players more driven than her. They're really good without her, but man, it wouldn't be anywhere close to being contenders without her in the lineup.
Case, we have about 30 seconds left. The Golden Knights are about to start their preseason. What are you going to be keeping your eye on as they head into the season?
Just a first-year coach. It's a big break for the organization, having Ryan Craig come in. We're used to them cycling through the biggest name every coaching cycle that they brought in the who's who of the NHL, and it's served them well so far. This is a guy they've built up from the beginning of the franchise. Excited to see what's different and how he does in his first year on the job.
Well, we are coming up against the clock, so we're going to have to leave it there. Case Kiefer is the assistant sports editor for the Las Vegas Sun. Mark Anderson covers Las Vegas sports for the Associated Press. Case, Mark, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us on, Paul.
Thank you.
We're back to KNPR State of Nevada. I'm Paul Boger. In Southern Nevada, home sales dropped nearly 12% in August. That's according to new data from Las Vegas Realtors. At the same time, the group reported about 7,600 single-family homes listed for sale at the end of August. That represents a 5% increase from the year before. So, with more inventory hitting the market and sales starting to decline, prices are set to fall, right? Well, only slightly. The median price for a single-family home last month was $475,000. That's down more than 1% from the all-time high of $490,000 set earlier in the summer, a price that remains out of reach for many Nevadans. To help offset the high cost of housing and increase development, Congress over the summer passed the 21st Century Road to Housing Act. It's a massive bipartisan effort meant to help more Americans afford a home. But will it help? That's the question I recently posed to Nicholas Irwin. He's the S.J. Hall Faculty Fellow in Economics at UNLV and the Research Director at the Lead Center for Real Estate. Here's that conversation. Nick, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Let's start by talking about the state of the real estate market in Nevada. The median price of a single-family home in Southern Nevada dipped to about $480,000 in July. That's down 2% from the all-time high this past May and June. Inventory is starting to creep up. Is that a sign the housing market is starting to cool off a little bit?
I think it's a sign that we are seeing people change their behaviors in response to what is persistently high mortgage rates. So you're seeing a lot of folks that are fewer people looking to buy houses. That's depressing those prices. There's less demand. And then some folks that would otherwise list a house, but they're worried they might be able to find a house on their end. So they're rate locked into their current home.
So does that mean that housing prices are going to start coming down at least a little bit in the near term?
Potentially, they could start coming down. You know, it's not going to be any big drops, but we could see a few, you know, percentage point decreases over the next couple of years. A lot of it really depends on what's happening with rates. We just reached a year high in terms of mortgage rates just this past week. And with what's happening in the bond market, I don't see any sign that's going to turn around within the next 6 to 12 months.
What are some of the other things that are continuing to drive the price of housing in Nevada?
What I'm going to mention is the same thing a lot of folks have been talking about for a while. It's just our availability of land. That's something that is outside of the control of the state. There are a lot of things we can do sort of on the margins, I think, at the state and local levels to help. But our biggest issue is the federal government controls an outsized proportion of our land. You know, it's over 85% in Clark County alone. Some counties, it's over 90%. through that restriction, it's very difficult to get that land allocated and get it out from federal ownership and onto the housing market. And we're seeing that with some of our you know, most recent land sales of BLM land. They're going for prices that the only things that can really pencil in are either affordable housing, assuming a developer can assemble their capital stack to account for the high value of land, or high-end housing. So if you're, you know, buying a 5 acres of land for $5 million, you can't build a lot of $300,000 homes on that land to make it pencil in. And then that's our biggest thing. That's what makes us unique, for better or worse, is that most of our land we don't control, and that does limit where we can build. So that just puts an artificial constraint on where we can build, and that pushes up prices, and that's a real issue we're confronting. 10, 20 years ago, we could just keep building out. Now, especially in Southern Nevada, we're starting to butt up against those limits.
There's also the continued narrative that folks from out of state, whether it be California or elsewhere, are able to sell their house for a lot more money there, come to Nevada, pay cash for a much cheaper home. Is that continuing to drive prices?
I mean, certainly that is a factor. You know, the Lead Center's done some research that suggests that the average person moving in state is wealthier based on IRS returns and looking at migration flows. They are wealthier than in-state residents. So that does put them in a better position to compete on the housing market. But you have to remember, housing is a two-sided transaction. Even if you want to help buyers, you have to think about what's going to happen on the seller end. When anyone sells their house, they want the highest possible value they can get. But when you're a buyer, you want the lowest possible price. And it's difficult to meet in the middle there sometimes. You know, the other issues, I know folks think, you know, the water is always a pressing issue in Southern Nevada, especially if you think about building more housing and our population growing, making sure we have sufficient water. That's not as big a concern, I think. I think between SMWA and efforts at the local and state level, we've done a good job. Some of those things may be outside of our control. And where that, you know, really might bite is, does that disincentivize new companies and new businesses from moving into Southern Nevada? And those same companies and businesses could, you know, bring more residents and pump more money into our economy, help our economy grow and diversify, bring in new residents. But if they're concerned about water or access to housing, that could be a potential discouragement. And we're already a very business friendly state. We certainly don't want to give the perception that these other things may push companies away.
This housing crunch isn't new. We've seen the median price of a home in Nevada rise roughly 40% in the last 6 years. That's per the Federal Reserve's economic data. Do we have any sense of just how much housing we need in this state?
Sure. If you don't mind, I'm going to add a little bit of color to that. Not only has that price gone up 40% of the past 6 years, since 2000, it's gone up 400%, but our incomes have only gone up 200%, at least in Las Vegas. And that's a real mismatch right there. In terms of how much housing we need, that's a really surprisingly complex question. We should know more about that. When it comes to low-income housing, the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, they do a really good tabulation of what's needed for people that are at or below what's called area median income, which is sort of the average income for a family of four. It's about $81,000 here in Southern Nevada. So we have a good idea of how many units are needed to for those folks. But for anyone above that limit, that missing middle, the, you know, starting teachers, you know, starting first responders, we don't have a good idea of what we need. It is certainly more units we're bringing online. Year to date, we are about 6,000 units have been, according to census permits, we've permitted. That puts us about around 40 in the nation in terms of MSAs. But the problem is we're closer to 30 when it comes to population. So we're not even building at the rate we need to with our given our current population. We're sort of falling behind a lot of other cities.
In that vein, lawmakers have been trying to tackle housing prices for years now. And just this summer, federal lawmakers approved a massive housing bill that would do a number of things. It has more than 50 sections. The law aims to just name a few, restrict corporate buyers, cut red tape, provide new financing tools. Break it down for me. What would this new federal housing law do?
Well, that's a great question. I think it depends on what your time frame. If you're thinking about tomorrow or next year, it's not going to do a lot. But each individual piece by itself won't do a lot, but it's sort of the net effect of all of them. A couple of the really interesting things that could be helpful for affordability. One of the things that it removes is the permanent chassis requirement for mobile homes. Currently, mobile homes are required to always have a chassis so they can be moved. but most of the time they're put into a permanent structure and a permanent foundation. But because of having this chassis, they can actually sort of restrict where they can go in. That's a problem that removed that. That's a big push a lot of housing folks have been pushing for, because that's, you know, modular housing is a potential way for a lot of folks to get into housing, especially seniors, because it tends to be much lower cost. There is going to be some exploratory programs on renovating and revitalizing old commercial vacant properties, sort of flipping those in. There's some federal funds to help with that. A pilot project, but if it has success, we could see more funds poured into that. They're looking at smaller mortgages, you know, $100,000 or less, which that could be helpful in certain parts of the state, much less helpful in our bigger cities. You mentioned the cutting the red tape. HUD is going to work on sort of a roadmap and work with local jurisdictions about how to think about cutting down things like parking requirements and changing minimum lot sizes. Also, we can make better use of land, which is a scarce resource in most major cities. And then the big one that a lot of folks are talking about that I know it's top of mind for a lot of people, especially this midterm cycle and for our assembly folks that will be seated in February, is corporate housing. The bill does restrict corporate housing. It's 350 houses is now the limit, but there are enough sort of ways around that that I don't know what effect that's going to have sort of in the long term. And even then, corporate ownership is a very, very small drop in the bucket when it comes to it. The bigger issue is just affordability. People want homes and they want to be able to afford to buy one. They can't because mortgage rates are too high. That's the biggest problem we have right now.
What about Nevada's relatively new attainable housing fund? Assembly Bill 540, the Nevada Housing Access and Attainability Act, was passed last year. It appropriated about $133 million to the newly created attainable housing account. That was intended to spur creation of new housing units for purchase and rent, along with additional resources like a down payment assistance program. That program came online earlier this year. Do we know yet if it's having any sort of impact?
It's definitely too soon to tell, but that bill, the work that Governor Lombardo and the legislature put together, I think that bill could have some real teeth behind it into the future. We're looking at 2 to 5 years. Right now, to the best of my knowledge, some of the funds have been allocated. I don't know to the extent construction has been broken ground, but more money towards building you know, affordable and attainable housing would be really helpful. One of the particular things in that bill that will be helpful is revising qualifications as well, having a higher AMI bar up to 150%. That's going to be really helpful for a lot of folks who just missed that cutoff. You know, we did some research this past year at the Lead Center for Real Estate, where I serve as a research director, where we found that the household income you need to comfortably afford a house in town is $120,000. Most of our jobs don't pay that. Especially if you're a single earner household. But those folks would fall into that 150% AMI limit. So they could be eligible for some of these programs. And I think that's a big expansion. It wouldn't surprise me if more states sort of start to expand that cap to allow more people to potentially qualify for some of these programs. So that's going to be the big effect. But again, it's probably a couple years out from really sort of seeing what the net effects are in the housing market from AB 540.
From your perspective, is there any way that Nevada will become a beacon of cheap housing like we saw in the 90s and 2000s?
I think that's going to be very difficult. And that's a real problem because folks remember that. That's within recent memory. That's within 20 years ago. It was, you know, right before the crash. You know, there were a lot of folks who could afford housing. And for a good long while in the state of Nevada from the 90s through before the crash, you know, income sort of tracked what average prices are. So it was really one member of the household could work or even two would be even better, and you could comfortably afford a nice home. And that's no longer the case. And I think that's difficult because a lot of folks remember that in town. And, you know, this is how I like to characterize our housing market versus our economy. We have we're a blue collar town, but we have white collar housing prices. And that's a difficult cycle to get out of.
While I have you here, let me ask, if you had a magic wand and you could wave it right now, what would be the one thing that you would do to drive housing prices down?
I don't think I would, even with a magic wand, I don't think I could control the bond market enough to impact the 10-year treasury to get mortgage rates down. So let's think of something realistic, because the bond market is, you know, the ever-present being that controls sort of everything in the economy. I would say have the federal government discharge their land, big chunks of land to us in Southern Nevada and Northern Nevada and every other county in all of Nevada, and let the local jurisdictions decide what's best for them and how to build out. I think that would be really helpful. And then you can see in this, you know, this the environment of our state democracy, different folks looking at different ways to do this. You know, what's best for Las Vegas and Clark County may not be best for what's best for Reno or for Pahrump or any of the other, you know, Elko. But providing us with the land and letting us do as we see fit and what's best for our residents, I think that'd be really helpful. I think we could see some real pushing down of housing prices over the next couple of years, if that could happen.
Nick Irwin is the S.J. Hall Faculty Fellow in Economics at UNLV and an associate professor in that department. He also serves as the research director for the LEED Center for Real Estate at UNLV. Nick, thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Paul.
On the Navajo Nation, where many homes lack electricity, coal can be a lifeline. And now that coal is being delivered much closer to home. For the Mountain West News Bureau, reporter Gabriel Pietrazio rides along in this, the second of a three-part series on Navajo coal country.
On this Christmas Eve, President Trump took calls from children wondering when St. Nick might land on their rooftop. Among them was 8-year-old Amelia from Kansas.
Santa will be coming down your chimney and have a beautiful present for you. What would you like Santa to bring?
Not coal.
Not coal. No, you don't want coal. Well, coal is, you mean clean, beautiful coal. I had to do that, I'm sorry. No, coal is clean and beautiful. Please remember that at all costs.
She'd rather get a Barbie, clothes, and candy. But for kids on the Navajo Nation, having a warm hogan during the wintertime might be the best holiday gift of all. That present isn't made at Santa's workshop, but right here, inside a 4-acre coal yard in New Mexico. So instead of Santa hand-delivering stockings of coal, along with his team of reindeer, it's Entech, or the Navajo Transitional Energy Company, with its diesel-powered trucks trekking across the sprawling res.
And these are actually going to the other side of the nation today. That's why we're not following those.
Andy Hawkins is Entech's community engagement manager. Together, we tailed a 20-ton coal truck making the rounds. It's frigid February as we follow it to Upper Fruitland near Farmington, New Mexico. Hawkins rummages through the pile and grabs a lump of coal.
For a one-room hogan, what you want to do is when you go to bed at night, you want to be able to throw a chunk in there and then for it to last. And something like this will get the job done for you.
This season, Entech made 130 bulk deliveries, like this one to Upper Fruitland. From every November to March, Entech is hauling coal at no cost to each of the 110 Navajo chapters, as well as a dozen Hopi villages. K-Nave Mark is in charge of the coal yard. She worries most about her elders.
Our young people are moving to town, Farmington and Gallup, but the elders are the ones that are really having a hard time making ends meet.
Despite deliveries to the Navajo chapter houses, many Diné still trek hours to the coal yard with tickets in hand. Each voucher is worth a ton, literally.
So we know on average, a scoop from the skid steer is a half a ton of coal. That's why he puts two scoops in.
In his annual address, tribal president Boo Nigrin pledged to keep this very mine and the Four Corners power plant up and running.
And we are so close to making sure that stays open till 2038, because those are hundreds and hundreds of jobs Those are millions and millions of dollars of revenue that the Navajo Nation receives.
Much like Trump, Nygren embraced the black substance, even snapping a selfie with Trump at the White House last year. One of his coined slogans, "Nygren digs coal," was something he was looking to do much more of, until his re-election bid fell short in last month's primary. So perhaps the next president may have a new outlook on coal in November. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio, reporting from the Navajo Mine.
Anime, or Japanese animation, has been surging in popularity over the last several decades. And like many other cultural phenomena, you can find it well represented in Las Vegas. Of course, there's these several anime conventions held throughout the year, but look around town. There are restaurants, stores, and bars that feature anime in some form. Even in our concert halls, the Las Vegas Philharmonic is set to perform the music of Japanese animation giant Studio Ghibli this very weekend. And our libraries features clubs and events centered on the culture, such as Sahara West Library's Teen Anime Fest on September 12th. Here to talk about that and the popularity of anime in the Las Vegas Clark County Library District is Bianca Ortiz Rodriguez, a Young People's Library Children's Services Assistant. Bianca, thanks for being here.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. How did the district know that they needed to book more anime events and clubs?
I think it's because, like you said, there's so much anime coming along mainstream in all the streaming services. As you said, there's so many conventions here. And I think we've just had it straight from the teens that, you know, it's something that they want, that's something that they're interested in. So we figured, you know, we might as well help them out, make it easier to have access for them, provide crafts for them to do that are based on all the anime that they're interested in.
So are we just talking about the cartoons, or are we talking about manga, Japanese graphic novels? Is that included in anime as well?
Oh, that's definitely included. A lot of the anime comes from the manga, since the manga is like the original source normally. But yeah, we have, for example, Manga Club at the East Las Vegas Library. You know, as a library, that's also something, another resource that we provide. So, you know, as a manga and anime lover myself, that's something that I always get. So we definitely want to make sure that we encourage that for teens, again, through clubs and our Teen Anime Fest.
So how popular is anime among library patrons? Is it mostly young people, or is it kind of a broad spectrum of patrons?
I would say it's a broad spectrum. I work in the children's department, so I've had young, you know, tweens or young children asking for manga. I have teens come up as well asking for manga, and adults, you know, they're reading, you know, a lot of anime and manga have been servicing since like the 90s, especially here. As a young kid, I've been reading manga my whole life and watching anime. So I have multiple adults asking for manga as well.
What goes on at the library's anime clubs? Are they social opportunities? Are they showing movies? Tell me what happens.
I would say it's all of that. It's definitely, I would say normally, you know, we're watching an anime that we ask the teens what they, you know, what they want to watch. So we'll show that anime as long as it's appropriate, of course. And then from there, we'll discuss what, you know, what they thought of it, if it was their first time watching it, if it hasn't been, you know, would they watch it again? We try to do crafts that go along with that anime too, just to give them something to do besides watching it. You know, we'll talk about the manga as well, if it came from that, would they continue reading it? So it's, and you know, just talking about that creates that social aspect. So that's what we try to do.
Let me ask you this. You're the co-chair of the committee for the Teen Anime Festival on Saturday. What should folks expect there?
A lot of things. We're very excited this year. We have an artist alley featuring local artists. And they're going to be selling their wares, all anime themed, of course. We're going to have a snack shop featuring Japanese snacks for teens, food trucks. We're going to have guests. I think our biggest guest this year is definitely a voice actress named Jenny Yokobari. And she's done different work in like Sanrio and everything. And so she's really cool. We're very excited for the teens to talk to her and ask her questions about voice acting and, you know, working in anime. We also have a lot of live performers that we've had, that we've seen from Anime Night Market. So
that, Bianca, that is actually where we're going to have to leave it. Bianca Ortiz Rodriguez is a Young People's Library Children's Services Assistant and co-chair of the upcoming festival. Bianca, thank you so much for speaking with me.
All right. Thank you for having me.
And as a note, the Las Vegas Clark County Library District is a financial supporter of Nevada Public Radio. Local fans have found a way to socialize around this ever-growing culture. Earlier this week, KNPR's Mike Privat spoke to Eric Pappas, the founder of the Anime Social Club in Las Vegas, which sports more than 1,300 members. Let's take a listen.
Eric, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So what made you want to start an anime-based social club here in Las Vegas?
Well, I've always been interested in anime, and I moved here in about 2016. And between then and when I started the club, I had a hard time finding people that would want to be social and also just people interested in anime as well. So that's why I started the club, because I want to find people who have the same interests as me and were looking for the same things that I was.
And as you were doing that, were you noticing that there was a need for things to do for people like you and the other new members of your new club that centered around anime? Was there, you know, did you find enough to do essentially?
Well, it was a little bit of search because the things that are available for anime folks around here are either arcades, bars, or festivals, and those are about once a year. So we kind of had to get a little creative with our events, but I think we found a lot of things that people enjoy.
Now, to back up a second here, why are you and maybe your fellow members so passionate about anime? What is it that draws you to it?
With anime, there's so many things to enjoy because it's as wide as a genre as cinema. It's hard to pinpoint exactly what interests each person, but I think you can find something for everyone.
And I got to ask, do you or maybe other people in the club, do they like to do the cosplaying, the dressing up like characters?
That's actually a very big part of it as well, and also just so much fun to see people come out in their own cosplays, because whether it's something they made themselves or something they bought online, it's just so interesting and fun to see how they put their spin on it. It blows my mind how creative some people can be.
Now, I guess this all raises the question, like, who is your typical, if there is a typical member of the Anime Social, who's coming to your events?
There is no typical, because it ranges from parents with their kids, and there's people just fresh out of high school or currently in high school that are just looking for other people who are also into anime. And then there's also people in their like mid-20s, mid-30s, and they're just more comfortable in themselves and want to just, again, meet other people that are into anime. And on the other side, you get people that are on the neurodivergent, and you get a lot of those in anime fans as well, because there is such a dramatic expression of emotion, and so it's that subtlety that gets lost can be a lot more clear and expressive. So I think that's why a lot of neurodivergent people enjoy anime, and we also try to make it as inclusive as possible for them as well.
Now, we mentioned earlier the Teen Anime Festival that's going to be at Sahara West Library this week, as well as the Studio Ghibli concerts by the Philharmonic. There's other events, you know, that pop up through the year. Do you find, as an anime fan, that there are plenty of anime-related events. To give the culture a strong showing here in Vegas, I guess ultimately I'm asking, is this a good city to be an anime fan?
Honestly, it's one of the better cities to be an anime fan in because there is such a wide range that caters to tourists and those are more mainstream. But as anime is becoming more mainstream, we are seeing a lot more events that are becoming popular and catered towards anime fans. And it's just it's a great time and a great city to be an anime fan.
Are you proud of the community you've helped foster with Anime Social?
Oh, the proudest, because they're just such wonderful people and amazing people. And I know personally my life has been better for meeting them. And I can't imagine being in the city and being as fulfilled as I am without them.
And that's Eric Pappas. He is the founder of the Anime Social Club, which you can find on meetup.com. Eric, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me. It was wonderful.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Back to talk about a few of the best options is KNPR's Mike Privat, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. And of course, there's a note, the Las Vegas Science and Natural History Museum, City of Las Vegas Cultural Affairs, and AEG Presents are all financial supporters of Nevada Public Radio. With that out of the way, hi, Mike.
Howdy, Paul.
Let's talk about Mexican Independence Day, which technically doesn't start until next Wednesday, but celebrations officially begin the day before on September 15th, and in Las Vegas, well, things have kind of already begun, haven't they?
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, we had discussed an event happening all this month at the Las Vegas Science and Natural History Museum. And the usual parade of concerts on the Strip featuring Latin artists has begun, Karin León being the first Mexican and Latino act ever to headline the Sphere. And our colleague Jimmy Romo sent me a clip of León's grand onstage intro for last week's residency debut. Pretty impressive, even as we've now all seen a billion Sphere TikTok clips over the last 3 years. Anyway, he's playing through the holiday weekend.
That doesn't sound like a cheap ticket.
No, which is why I've highlighted a few things that locals can partake in with no hit to the wallet, and they're all away from the tourist corridor. These are in large part because of the city of Las Vegas, and here's a lightning round list, if you will. Now, one that's friendly with folks out in the northwest corner of the valley is the Independencia de Mexico event at Centennial Hills Park Amphitheater, and that will have live music and traditional dance performances. That's on September 12th. And then there's a similar celebration happening on Tuesday the 15th with Viva Mexico, El Grito de Independencia, and that's at the Las Vegas Civic Center downtown, and that's produced in part by the Mexican Consulate.
Is there a difference between the two festivals?
So what will mark Viva Mexico is the traditional ceremony of the El Grito de Dolores, which translates to the Cry of Dolores, and that was the call of arms that began the Mexican War of Independence. Now, if you want to commemorate the holiday, maybe in a more subdued way, City Hall has an art exhibition. It's called Somos Magia. That translates to We Are Magic, and that's up through November 19th. It's curated by local artist Heidi Calle. She put together a show that taps into the magical realism that plays such a huge part in the images and words of Mexico.
And we should add that the city has even more Mexican and Latin programming through September and into October. Now, Mike, I see that you want to talk about the Great Reno Balloon Race.
I actually want you to talk about the Great Reno Balloon Race because you've been there. So I'm asking you to set the scene. What's it like?
It's a lot of fun, actually, for the whole family. First off, the name of the race is a bit of a misnomer. Yes, there is a race, but that's almost solely for the enjoyment of the balloonists. For everyone else, the spectacle is the early morning glow show. That's where a handful of balloons set up in a line in the middle of the field at Rancho San Rafael Park while it's still dark and perform a coordinated light show set to music. Then once the sun comes up, there's mass ascension where about anywhere from 50 to 75 balloons, all different shapes, sizes, colors, characters, they all rise into that bright blue northern Nevada sky. It's absolutely fun to watch.
And at the same time, there's vendors and performances going on while this is taking place. And one of the great things is that you can be on the field while all this is going on. So you can actually talk to folks while they're setting up the balloon, actually get to, you know, help a little bit if you want to. So lots of fun for everybody.
Now, you said it's still dark. So wait, is this an all-day affair or just in the morning?
It's definitely a morning thing, a very, very early morning thing. And if you're going, I recommend trying to get there as early as you can. Around 3:30 in the morning has worked pretty well for me.
Wow.
Even still, there's going to be a lot of traffic. There's anywhere between 15, 20,000 people at Rancho San Rafael during these events every single day. So just bring your patience. Also, bring a blanket and a sweater because it's definitely going to get chilly as we're hanging out on the field.
So after party, that's basically brunch?
Pretty much. It's either that or a nap. I prefer both.
Mm-hmm. I should add that this is a four-day event, so you get four different mornings to choose from. That's September 10th through the 13th. And also, it's the 45th balloon race, which means, I think officially, this is a Nevada institution.
I think so. Speaking of another Nevada institution, it looks like we have some Bard in the Park with Las Vegas' favorite Shakespeare character.
Yeah, in Boulder City as well. Nevada Shakespeare Festival, which we have featured on this program, and they pride themselves on very modern, often irreverent interpretation of old Will's works. They're staging Julius Caesar. Now, NSF has already staged the big JC over at the Windmill Library. That was in late August. So this production should benefit from the running start. And I'm hearing that this production of Julius Caesar, which is normally a tragedy, is actually funny. Can the fall of Republic be funny with, you know, everything happening in the world?
What's that Marcus Aurelius quote? Look back over the past with its changing empires that rose and fell, and you too can foresee the future?
Very nice, Paul. Very, very nice. In any event, we will find out how it works on September 11th at Bicentennial Park. And if you can't make this one, there are two more performances elsewhere in Southern Nevada in October. All performances are free.
That's all the time we have for this week. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Paul.